something really takes a swing for the fences, when something really knocks it out of the borders and rearranges all the usual orders. That's exactly what the track you were on did, and it was exactly just what nobody wanted. A berserk sea that fluttered in and receded. You were so perfectly what nobody needed. It pushed as far as you could make an idea go, and it exactly made an impact of zero. And basically the public never responded. You were so amazingly what nobody wanted. I held on tight to every scrap that I took in, but it's like it all happened when nobody was looking. But to me it was so awesome.
And you're also awesome. You're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM. And coming up next is Fiction Jones after a couple of brief announcements.
Hi, I'm Mel from The Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 1 Franklin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting-looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.
We'll be right back. You will now listen to my voice. My voice will help you and guide you still deeper into Europa. Every time you hear my voice, with every word and every number, you will enter a still deeper layer, open, relaxed, and receptive. I shall now count from 1 to 10. On the count of 10, you will be in Europa. I say 1. And as you focus your attention entirely on my voice, you will slowly begin to relax. 2. Your hands and your fingers are getting warmer and heavier. 3. The warmth is spreading through your arms, to your shoulders and your neck. 4. Your feet and your legs get heavier. 5. The warmth is spreading to the whole of your body. On 6, I want you to go deeper. I say 6. And the whole of your relaxed body is slowly beginning to sink. 7. You go deeper and deeper and deeper. 8. On every breath you take, you go deeper. 9. You are floating. On the mental count of 10, you will be in Europa. Be there at 10. I say 10. You are listening to the noise of rain beating against a large metal drum. Go closer. There's a fence, and you have to stop. You're walking across the rail yard, and you've been traveling by train from Bremerhaven, and before that, on a ship from New York. You are in Germany. The year is 1945.
You are in Germany. But the year is 1818. The world of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Welcome to Fiction Jones and part 12 of Frankenstein. In this part of the book, about two-thirds of the way through, Dr. Frankenstein has encountered his creation again, promised him to create a mate to relieve his horrible suffering and loneliness. But Victor Frankenstein is hesitating, and that hesitation will cost him dearly. Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, coming up next on Fiction Jones. In my retreat, I devoted the morning to labor. But in the evening, when the weather permitted, I walked on the stony beach of the sea to listen to the waves as they roared and dashed at my feet. It was a monotonous, yet ever-changing scene. I thought of Switzerland. It was far different from this desolate and appalling landscape. Its hills are covered with vines, and its cottages are scattered thickly in the plains. Its fair lakes reflect a blue and gentle sky. And when troubled by the winds, their tumult is but as the plain of a lively instant, when infant, when compared to the roarings of the giant ocean. In this manner, I distributed my occupations when I first arrived. But as I proceeded in my labor, it became every day more horrible, irksome to me. Sometimes I could not prevail on myself to enter my laboratory for several days, and at other times I toiled day and night in order to complete my work. It was indeed a filthy process in which I was engaged. During my first experiment, a kind of enthusiastic frenzy had blinded me to the horror of my employment. My mind was intently fixed on the sequence of my labor, and my eyes were shut to the horror of my proceedings. But now I went to it in cold blood, and my heart often sickened at the work of my hands. I had left Germany to this remote place in Scotland to pursue my work, and thus situated, I was employed in the most detestable occupation, now immersed in a solitude where nothing could for an instant call my attention from the actual scene in which I was engaged. My spirits became unequal. I grew restless and nervous. Every moment I feared to meet my persecutor. Sometimes I sat with my eyes fixed on the ground, fearing to raise them lest they should encounter the object which I so much dreaded to behold. I feared to wander from the sight of my fellow creatures, lest, when alone, he should come to claim his companion. In the meantime, I worked on, and my labor was already considerably advanced. I looked towards its completion with a tremulous and eager hope, which I dared not trust myself to question, but which was intermixed with obscure forebodings of evil that made my heart sicken in my bosom. Chapter 3. I sat one evening in my laboratory. The sun had set, and the moon was just rising from the sea. I had not sufficient light for my employment, and I remained idle, in a pause of consideration of whether I should leave my labor for the night or hasten its conclusion by an unremitting attention to it. As I sat, a train of reflection occurred to me, which led me to consider the effects of what I was now doing. 3 years before, I was engaged in the same manner and had created a fiend whose unparalleled barbarity had desolated my heart and filled it forever with the bitterest remorse. I was now about to form another being of whose dispositions I was alike ignorant. She might become 10,000 times more malignant than her mate, and delight for its own sake in murder and wretchedness. He had sworn to quit the neighborhood of man and hide himself in deserts, but she had not, and she, who in all probability was to become a thinking and reasoning animal, might refuse to comply with a compact made before her creation. They might even hate each other. The creature who had already lived loathed his own deformity, and might he not conceive a greater abhorrence for it when it came before his eyes in the female form? She also might turn with disgust from him, to the superior beauty of man. She might quit him, and he be again alone, exasperated by the fresh provocation of being deserted by one of his own species. Even if they were to leave Europe and inhabit the deserts of the New World, yet one of the first results of those sympathies for which the daemon thirsted would be children, and a race of devils would be propagated upon the earth who might make the very existence of the species of man a condition precarious and full of terror. Had I a right, for my own benefit, to inflict this curse upon everlasting generations? I had before been moved by the sophisms of this being that I had created. I had been struck senseless by his fiendish threats. But now, for the first time, the wickedness of my promise burst upon me. I shudder to think that future ages might curse me as their pest, whose selfishness had not hesitated to buy its own peace at the price, perhaps, of the existence of the whole human race. I trembled, and my heart failed within me, when, on looking up, I saw, by the light of the moon, the daemon at the casement. A ghastly grin wrinkled his lips as he gazed on me, where I sat fulfilling the task which he had allotted to me. Yes, he had followed me in my travels. He had loitered in forests, hid himself in caves, or taken refuge in wide and desert heaths. And he was now come to mark my progress and claim the fulfillment of my promise. As I looked on him, his countenance expressed the utmost extent of malice and treachery. I thought with a sensation of madness on my promise of creating another like to him, and trembling with passion, tore to pieces the thing on which I was engaged. The wretch saw me destroy the creature on whose future existence he depended for happiness, and with a howl of devilish despair and revenge, withdrew. I left the room, and locking the door, made a solemn vow in my own heart never to resume my labors. And then, with trembling steps, I sought my own apartment. I was alone. None were near me to dissipate the gloom and relieve me from the sickening oppression of the most terrible of reveries. Several hours passed, and I remained near my window, gazing on the sea. It was almost motionless, for the winds were hushed, and all nature reposed under the eye of the quiet moon. A few fishing vessels alone specked the water, and now and then the gentle breeze wafted the sound of voices as the fishermen called to one another. I felt the silence, although I was hardly conscious of its extreme profundity, until my ear was suddenly arrested by the paddling of oars near the shore and a person landing close to my house. In a few minutes after, I heard the creaking of my door as if someone endeavored to open it softly. I trembled from head to foot. I felt a presentiment of who it was, and I wished to rouse one of the peasants who dwelt in a cottage not far from mine. But I was overcome by the sensation of helplessness so often felt in frightful dreams, when you in vain endeavor to fly from an impending danger, and was rooted to the spot. Presently I heard the sound of footsteps alone along the passage. The door opened, and the wretch whom I had dreaded appeared. Shutting the door, he approached me and said, in a smothered voice, "You've destroyed the work which you began. What is it that you intend? Do you dare to break your promise? I have endured toil and misery. I left Switzerland with you. I crept along the shores of the Rhine, among its willow islands, and over the summits of its hills. I've dwelt many months in the heaths of England and among the deserts of Scotland. I have endured incalculable fatigue and cold and hunger. Do you dare destroy my hopes? Be gone. I do not break my promise. Never will I create another like yourself, equal in deformity and wickedness. I do break my promise. Slave, I before reasoned with you, but you have proved yourself unworthy of my condescension. Remember that I have self and power. You believe yourself miserable, but I can make you so wretched that the light of day will be hateful to you. You are my creator, but I am your master. Obey. The hour of my weakness is past, and the period of your power is arrived. Your threats cannot move me to do an act of wickedness, but they confirm me in a resolution of not creating you a companion in vice. Shall I, in cool blood, set loose upon the earth a daemon, whose delight is in death and wretchedness? Be gone. I am firm, and your words will only exasperate my rage. The monster saw my determination in my face and gnashed his teeth in the impotence of anger. Shall each man, cried he, find a wife for his bosom, and each beast have his mate, and I be alone? I had feelings of affection, and they were requited by detestation and scorn. Man, you may hate, but beware. Your hours will pass in dread and misery, and soon the bolt will fall which must ravage you from your happiness forever. Are you to be happy while I grovel in the intensity of my wretchedness? You can blast my other passions, but revenge remains. Revenge, henceforth dearer than light or food. I may die, but first you, henceforth dearer. My tyrant and tormentor shall curse the sun that gazes on your misery. With the wiliness of a snake, that I may sting with its venom, man, you shall repent of the injuries you inflict. Devil, cease, and do not poison the air with these sounds of malice. I've declared my resolution to you, and I am no coward to bend beneath words. Leave me. I am inexorable. It's well, I go, but remember, I shall be with you on your wedding night. I started forward and exclaimed, villain, before you sign my death warrant, be sure that you are yourself safe. I would have seized him, but he eluded me and quitted the house with precipitation. In a few moments, I saw him in his boat, which shot across the waters with an arrowy swiftness and was soon lost amidst the waves. All was silent again, but his words rung in my ears. I burned with rage to pursue the murderer of my peace and precipitate him into the ocean. I walked up and down my room hastily and perturbed, while my imagination conjured up a thousand images to torment and sting me. Why had I not followed him, closed with him in mortal strife? But I'd suffered him to depart, and he had directed his course towards the mainland. I shuddered to think who might be the next victim, sacrificed to his insatiate revenge. And then I thought again of his words, "I will be with you on your wedding night." That then was the period fixed for the fulfillment of my destiny. In that hour, I should die, and at that once satisfied and extinguish his malice. The prospect did not move me to fear, yet when I thought of my beloved Elizabeth, of her tears and endless sorrow, when she would find her lover so barbarously snatched from her, tears, the first I had shed for many months, streamed from my eyes, and I resolved not to fall before my enemy without a bitter struggle. The night passed away, and the sun rose from the ocean. My feelings became calmer, if it may be called calmness, when the violence of rage sinks into the depths of despair. I left the house, the horrid scene of last night's contention. I walked on the beach of the sea, which I almost regarded as an insuperable barrier between me and my fellow creatures. Nay, a wish that such should prove the facts stole across me. I desired that I might pass my life on that barren rock, wearily, it is true, but uninterrupted by any sudden shock of misery. If I returned, it was to be sacrificed, or to see those whom I most loved die under the grasp of a daemon whom I had myself created. I walked about the isle like a restless specter, separated from all it loved and miserable in the separation. When it became noon and the sun rose higher, I lay down on the grass and was overpowered by a deep sleep. I had been awake the whole of the preceding night. My nerves were agitated and my eyes inflamed by watching and misery. The sleep in which I now sunk refreshed me, and when I awoke, I again felt as if I belonged to a race of human beings like myself, and I began to reflect upon what had passed with greater composure. Yet still the words of the fiend rung in my ears like a death knell. They appeared like a dream, yet distinct and oppressive as reality. The sun had far descended, and I still sat on the shore, satisfying my appetite, which had become ravenous, with an oaten cake, when I saw a fishing boat land close to me, and one of the men brought me a packet. It contained letters from Geneva and one from Clerval, entreating me to join him. He said that nearly a year had elapsed since we had quitted Switzerland, and France was yet unvisited. He entreated me, therefore, to leave my solitary isle and meet him at Perth in a week from that time, when we might arrange the plan of our future proceedings. This letter, in a degree, recalled me to life, and I determined to quit my island at the expiration of 2 days. Yet before I departed, there was a task to perform on which I shuddered to reflect. I must pack my chemical instruments, and for that purpose I must enter the room which had been the scene of my odious work, and I must handle those utensils, the sight of which was sickening to me. The next morning, at daybreak, I summoned sufficient courage and unlocked the door of my laboratory. The remains of the half-finished creature whom I had destroyed lay scattered on the floor, and I almost felt as if I had mangled the living flesh of a human being. I paused to collect myself and then entered the chamber. With a trembling hand, I conveyed the instruments out of the room, but I reflected that I ought not leave the relics of my work to excite the horror and suspicion of the peasants, and I accordingly put them in a basket with a great quantity of stones, and laying them up, determined to throw them into the sea that very night. And in the meantime, I sat upon the beach, employed in cleaning and arranging my chemical apparatus. Nothing could be more complete than the alteration that had taken place in my feelings since the night of the appearance of the daemon. I had before regarded my promise with a gloomy despair as a thing that, with whatever consequences, must be fulfilled. But I now felt as if a film had been taken away before my eyes, and that I, for the first time, saw clearly. The idea of renewing my labors did not for one instant occur to me. The threat I had heard weighed upon my thoughts, but I did not reflect that a voluntary act of mine could avert it. I had resolved in my own mind that to create another like the fiend I had first made would be an act of the basest and most atrocious selfishness, and I banished from my mind every thought that could lead to a different conclusion. Between 2 and 3 in the morning, the moon rose. I then, putting my basket aboard a little skiff, sailed out about 4 miles from the shore. The scene was perfectly solitary. A few boats were returning toward the land, but I sailed away from them. I felt as if I was about the commission of a dreadful crime, and avoided with shuddering anxiety any encounter with my fellow creatures. At one time the moon, which had before been clear, was suddenly overspread by a thick cloud, and I took advantage of the moment of darkness and cast my basket into the sea. I listened to the gurgling sound as it sunk, and then sailed away from the spot. The sky became clouded, but the air was pure, although chilled by the northeast breeze that was then rising. But it refreshed me, and filled me with such agreeable sensations that I had resolved to prolong my stay on the water, and fixing the rudder in a direct position, stretched myself at the bottom of the boat. Clouds hid the moon. Everything was obscure. I heard only the sound of the boat as its keel cut through the waves. The murmur lulled me, and in a short time I slept. soundly. I do not know how long I remained in this situation, but when I awoke, I found that the sun had already mounted considerably. The wind was high, and the waves continually threatened the safety of my little skiff. I found that the wind was northeast and must have driven me far from the coast from which I had embarked. I endeavored to change my course, but quickly found that if again I made the attempt, the boat would be instantly filled with water. Thus situated, my only resource was to drive before the wind. I confess that I felt a few sensations of terror. I had no compass with me, and was so little acquainted with the geography of this part of the world, the sun was of little benefit to me. I might be driven into the wide Atlantic and feel all the tortures of starvation, or be swallowed up in the immeasurable waters that roared and buffeted around me. I had already been out for many hours, and I felt the torment of a burning thirst, a prelude to my other sufferings. I looked on the heavens, which were covered by clouds that flew before the wind, only to be replaced by others. I looked upon the sea, as if it was to become my grave. "Fiend," I exclaimed, "your task is already fulfilled." I thought of Elizabeth, of my father, of Clerval. I sunk into reverie, so despairing, so frightful, that even now, when the scene is on the point of closing before me forever, I shudder to reflect on it. Some hours passed, but by degrees, as the sun declined towards the horizon, the wind died away into a gentle breeze, and the sea became free from breakers. But these gave place to a heavy swell. I felt sick and hardly able to hold the rudder, when suddenly I saw a line of high land toward the south. Almost spent as I was by fatigue and the dreadful suspense I endured for several hours, this sudden certainty of life rushed like a flood of warm joy to my heart, and tears gushed from my eyes. How mutable are our feelings! How strange is that clinging love we have of life in the excess of misery. I constructed another sail with a part of my dress and eagerly steered my course towards the land. It had a wild and rocky appearance, but as I approached nearer, I easily perceived the traces of cultivation. I saw vessels near the shore, and found myself suddenly transported back to the neighborhood of civilized man. I eagerly traced the windings of the land. I hailed a steeple, which I at length saw issuing from behind a small promontory. As I was in a state of extreme debility, I resolved to sail directly towards the town as a place where I could most easily procure nourishment. Fortunately, I had money with me. As I turned the promontory, I perceived a small, neat town with a good harbor, which I entered, my heart bounding with joy with my unexpected escape. Thank you. As I was occupied in fixing the boat and arranging the sails, several people crowded towards the spot. They seemed very much surprised at my appearance, but with gestures that at any other time might have produced in me a slight sensation of alarm. As it was, I merely remarked that they spoke English, and I therefore addressed them in that language. "My good friends," said I, "will you be so kind as to tell me the name of this town? Inform me where I am?" "You will know that soon enough," replied a man with a gruff voice. "Maybe you are come to a place that will not prove much to your taste, but you will not be consulted as to your quarters, I promise you." I was exceedingly surprised on receiving so rude an answer from a stranger, and I was also disconcerted on perceiving the frowning and angry countenances of his companions. "Why do you answer me so roughly?" I replied. "Surely it's not the custom of Englishmen to receive strangers so inhospitably." "I do not know," said the man, "what the custom of the English may be, but it is the custom of the Irish to hate villains." While this strange dialogue continued, I perceived the crowd rapidly increase. Their faces expressed a mixture of curiosity and anger, which annoyed and in some degree alarmed me. I inquired the way to the inn, but no one replied. I then moved forward, and a murmuring sound arose from the crowd as they followed and surrounded me, when an ill-looking man approaching tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Come, sir, you must follow me to Mr. Kerwin's to give an account of yourself." "Who is Mr. Kerwin? Why am I to give an account of myself? Is this not a free country?" "Aye, sir, free enough for honest folks. Mr. Kerwin is a magistrate, and you are to give an account of the death of a gentleman who was found murdered here last night." This answer startled me, but I presently recovered myself. I was innocent. That could easily be proved. Accordingly, I followed my conductor in silence and was led by one of the best houses to the town. I was ready to sink from fatigue and hunger, but being surrounded by a crowd, I thought it politic to rouse all my strength, that no physical disability might be construed into apprehension or conscious guilt. Little did I then expect the calamity that was in a few moments to overwhelm me and extinguish in horror and despair all fear of ignominy or death. I must pause here, for it requires all my fortitude to recall the memory of the frightful events which I am about to relate in proper detail to my recollection. Chapter 4. I was soon introduced into the presence of the magistrate, an old benevolent man with calm and mild manners. He looked upon me, however, with some degree of severity, and then, turning towards my conductors, he asked who appeared as witnesses on this occasion. About half a dozen men came forward, and one being selected by the magistrate, he deposed that he had been out fishing the night before with his son and brother-in-law, Daniel Nugent, when about 10 o'clock they observed a strong northerly blast rising, and they accordingly put in for port. It was a very dark night, as the moon had not yet risen. They did not land at the harbor, but as they were been accustomed, at a creek about 2 miles below. He walked on first, carrying a part of a fishing tackle, and his companions followed him at some distance. As he was proceeding along the sands, he stuck his foot against something and fell all his length on the ground. His companions came up to assist him, and by the light of their lantern they found that what they had fallen on was the body of a man who was, to all appearances, dead. Their first supposition was that it was the corpse of some person who had been drowned and was thrown on shore by the waves, but upon examination, they found that the clothes were not wet, and even that the body was not even cold. They instantly carried it to the cottage of an old woman near the spot and endeavored, but in vain, to restore it to life. He appeared to be a handsome young man, about 25 years of age. He had apparently been strangled, but there was no sign of any violence except the black marks of fingers on his neck. The first part of this description did not in the least interest me, but when the mark of the fingers were mentioned, I remembered the murder of my brother, and I felt myself extremely agitated. My limbs trembled, and a mist came over my eyes, which obliged me to lean on a chair for support. The magistrate observed me with a keen eye, and of course drew an unfavorable augury from my manner. The son confirmed his father's account, but when Daniel Nugent was called, he swore positively that just before the fall of his companion, he saw a boat with a single man in it at a short distance from the shore. And as far as he could judge by the light of a few stars, it was the same boat in which I had just landed. A woman deposed that she lived near the beach and was standing at the door of her cottage, waiting for the return of a fisherman, when an hour before she heard of the discovery of the body, when she saw a boat with only one man in it, pushed off from that part of the shore where the corpse was afterward found. Another woman confirmed the account of the fisherman having brought the body into the house. It was not cold. They put it into a bed, they rubbed it, and Daniel went to the town for an apothecary, but the life was quite gone. Several other men were examined concerning my landing, and they agreed that, with the strong north wind that had risen during the night, it was very probable that I had beaten about for many hours and had been obliged to return nearly to the same spot from which I had departed. Besides, they observed that it appeared that I had brought the body from another place, and it was likely that, as I did not appear to know the shore, I might have put into the harbor ignorant of the distance of the town from the place where I deposited the corpse. Mr. Kerwin, on hearing this evidence, desired that I should be taken into the room where the body lay for the interment, that it might be observed what effect the sight of it would produce upon me. This idea was probably suggested by the extreme agitation I had exhibited when the mode of the murder had been described. I was accordingly conducted by the magistrate and several other peoples to the inn. I could not help being struck by the strange coincidences that had taken place during this eventful night, but knowing that I had been conversing with several persons in the island I had inhabited about the time the body had been found, I was perfectly tranquil as to the consequences of the affair. I entered the room where the corpse lay. I was led up to the coffin. How can I describe my sensations on beholding it? I feel yet parched with horror, nor can I reflect on that terrible moment without shuddering in agony that faintly reminds me of the anguish of the recognition, the trial, the presence of the magistrate and the witnesses passed like a dream from my memory when I saw the lifeless form of Henry Clerval stretched before me. I gasped for breath, and throwing myself on the body, I exclaimed, Have my murderous machinations deprived you also, my dearest Henry, of life? Two I have already destroyed. Other victims await their destiny. But you, Clerval, my friend, my benefactor? The human frame could no longer support the agonizing suffering that I endured, and I was carried out of the room in strong convulsions. A few succeeded to this. A fever from which I lay for 2 months on the point of death. My ravings, as I afterward heard, were frightful. I called myself the murderer of William, of Justine, of Clerval. Sometimes I entreated my attendants to assist me in the destruction of the fiend by whom I was tormented. And at others I felt the fingers of the monster already grasping my neck, and screamed aloud with agony and terror. Fortunately, as I spoke my native language, Mr. Kirwin alone understood me. But my gestures and bitter cries were sufficient to affright the other witnesses. Why did I not die? More miserable than man ever was before, why did I not sink into forgetfulness and rest? Death snatches away many blooming children and the only hopes of their doting parents. How many brides and youthful lovers have been one day in the bloom of health and hope, and the next a prey for worms and the decay of the tomb? Of what materials was I made that I could thus resist so many shocks, which, like the turning of the wheel, continuously renewed the torture? But I was doomed to live, and in 2 months found myself as awakening from a dream in a prison, stretched on a wretched bed, surrounded by gaolers, turnkeys, and bolts, and all the miserable apparatus of a dungeon. It was morning, I remember, when I thus awoke to understanding. I had forgotten the particulars of what had happened, and only felt as if some great misfortune had suddenly overwhelmed me. But when I looked around, I saw the barred windows, the squalidness of the room in which I was, all flashed across my memory, and I groaned bitterly. This sound disturbed an old woman who was sleeping in a chair beside me. She was a hired nurse, the wife of one of the turnkeys, and her countenance expressed all those bad qualities which had often characterized that class The lines of her face were hard and rude, like that of persons accustomed to seeing without sympathizing in sights of misery. Her tone expressed her entire indifference. She addressed me in English, and the voice struck me as one that I had heard during my sufferings. "Are you better now, sir?" said she. And that was part 12 of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I hope you can join me again on the third Friday of next month for part 13. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM right here in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up next, Rick has arrived in the studio with the XL290 Radio Hour. Stay tuned for that and all the other great programming. And it's not Rick, but but I'm sure an able substitute who will fill in.
I'm a facsimile.
Okay, an able facsimile. Sounds good. All right. Thank you for tuning in tonight. Thanks so much for your support during the pledge drive. I didn't really mention that last show, and it meant a whole lot to me, so thank you so much for all the support you offered to this show and all of the other programming, too. We're on the way to some great new equipment here. I'm seeing it getting set up as we speak, so stay tuned for that. And have a wonderful week. Keep warm, and it's wet and cold, so be safe. And I'll see you next month.
Support for this program is provided by Madison Locally Sourced, formerly known as Madison Essentials. Madison Locally Sourced publishes 6 issues annually, each filled with intriguing stories about the people, places, and things that create the communities we love. Available in print at over 150 convenient locations or read online at madisonlocallysourced.com.
The Salon Piano Series presents Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes on Saturday, April 6th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 7th at 2 p.m. at Farley's House of Pianos. Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes, two of the premier pianists in jazz who are also husband and wife, have joined forces to record their first collaborative album, Double Portrait on Blue Note. Their live shows feature lively renditions of exquisite four-hand jazz piano duets. More information can be found at salonpianoseries.org. The Salon Piano Series presents Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes on Saturday, April 6th and Sunday, April 7th at Farley's House of Pianos, 6522 Siebold Road in Madison. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
Yes, this is WORT 89.